Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Doug Sovereign, political reporter for KCBS Radio in San Francisco and your moderator for today's program. And it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, E.J. Dionne Jr., Washington Post columnist, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and author of the new book, Our Divided Political Heart, The Battle for the American Idea in the Age of Discontent. I had the pleasure of working with E.J. Dionne many years ago, when we were both at the New York Times, he in a much more exalted position than I. And after 14 years at the Times, he went on to the Washington Post, first as a national political reporter, then as a columnist. He also appears each week on NPR. He's a regular on NBC's Meet the Press. You may have seen him also on MSNBC. He's a nationally syndicated political columnist. His columns in more than 100 newspapers nationwide. He's the author of no fewer than 10 books, including the seminal bestseller, Why Americans Hate Politics. And even if you do hate politics, it is very hard not to like E.J. Dionne. So please welcome E.J. Dionne.
What a lovely last line that was. I'm going to remember that. And that was so much nicer. Whenever I get a nice introduction like that, I like to remember the one I got when I was speaking somewhere in the Midwest, and the person introducing me ended, and now for the latest dope from Washington, here's E.J. Dionne. So, Doug, thank you. Thank you so much. And, you know, it was so long ago that we met. I feel we met during the Coolidge campaign or something, but thank you. I can't tell you what an honor it is to be here at the Commonwealth Club. This is an absolutely extraordinary place. And in the course of my talk toward the end, I'm going to be quoting a speech that was given here 80 years ago, this September 23rd, one of the most important speeches Franklin D. Roosevelt gave in his entire political life was given here at the Commonwealth Club. But just for fun, I went back and looked at who was here 50 years ago around this time, and I discovered that on May 18th, Richard Nixon offered his program to streamline California government. You remember? He was running for governor of California at that time. And John Kenneth Galbraith came here on June 4th. There was, on June 12th, the annual ladies' evening. Now, isn't that interesting to think about in 2012? And among other people who were honored that night were Wallace Stegner and Leon Uris. Am I right? Is it Wallace Stegner was around then? I just looked this up. But here's the best. On June 22nd, 1962, there was a debate here at the Commonwealth Club about the King-Anderson Bill. And the King-Anderson Bill was the bill that included Medicare. And it actually went down that time, but eventually was passed. But here is something that was said in that debate, I hope I have his name right, by Ivan Nestingen, who was the undersecretary of HEW in the Kennedy administration. And this seems terribly appropriate to quote as we await the Supreme Court's judgment on the Affordable Care Act. Here is what the gentleman said. He said, "We find the AMA making the allegations that government committees will determine whether an elderly patient will be admitted to a hospital." I'm not making this up. If this were in the bill, I wouldn't blame one doctor for opposing it. But government committees will not determine whether a patient will be admitted to a hospital or how long he will stay. It makes you wonder if we'll be arguing about this 100 years from now. But that's amazing. I do also, nobody gets to be up here without other people being responsible for it. And so I do want to thank Dr. Gloria Duffy and George Dobbins. I also want to thank Ricardo Esway and Andre Hurd, who are handling sound and video today. You wouldn't hear or see me without them. As you know, it's also very kind to for the Commonwealth Club ever to have a journalist. We are not in very high esteem, which is why I am very grateful that lawyers and investment bankers exist, because thanks to them, we are sometimes kept out of the bottom of some of those poll ratings. And many people think we journalists are arrogant. Indeed, many people think we work at it. And I just want you to know that thanks to the new technologies, both those comments underneath your column and then all the email you get when your little address is underneath your column, you hear quite a lot from readers. And human nature being what it is, perhaps it's original sin, we hear a lot more from readers who disagree with us most of the time than from readers who agree with us. Now, because this is an exceedingly polite audience, probably a majority of my email is not repeatable here today. But I do want to share one of my favorite ones, which began, "Dear Mr. Dion, are you as dumb in person?" And so the fact is that whatever else you get out of my talk tonight, you will be able to answer that question for your self. And I just have to say, I love, you know, I'm from Massachusetts, where politics isn't necessarily always on the level, though I do love my dear home state's politics. Indeed, the late Mary McGrory, one of my favorite people in the world, once said that every baby born in Massachusetts is born with a campaign manager's gene. But coming from Massachusetts as I do, I'm very grateful for the state of Louisiana, which can succeed sometimes in making us look on the level. And you may be worried about how nasty and negative this campaign that we're about to embark on or are in the middle of is will become, and I am sure that's true. I'm worried about it as well. But I do want to remind you of a wonderful Louisiana politician. He actually went to the slammer, but he's still an extraordinary politician named Edwin Edwards. And the great thing about Edwin Edwards is he knew that everybody else knew the kind of guy he was. And so when he was up for a re-election one year in the middle of a deep recession, he was trying to get back into office against an incumbent Republican, and he went all over the state and said, if you re-elect my opponent, there'll be nothing left for me to steal. And he kept his promise. The economy improved, and subsequent events suggested he kept the other half of the promise. But my favorite thing is during a debate, he looked at his opponent and he said, my opponent is so dumb that it takes him 2 hours to watch 60 minutes. So try that on one of your best friends someday and see what happens. I'm going to put that there for the moment. I am here to talk about Our Divided Political Heart, my book. I just want to remind you that for anyone who forgot to give a gift to that beloved father, grandfather, father-in-law, there are books for sale outside after the show. And the book is rooted in the idea that we Americans are a very confusing people, and perhaps especially to ourselves. The self-portraits we paint of ourselves are often contradictory. The products of our culture all seem to celebrate conflicting values. Is our country better personified by that great community, the great community spirit of Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life, or in the rogue individualism of Clint Eastwood in Dirty Harry, or for that matter, of the Clint Eastwood in the recent Chrysler commercials? Does Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land or Frank Sinatra's My Way speak more directly to our character? Is the American experiment unique because it recognizes the importance of solidarity as illustrated in the novels of John Steinbeck, or because it acknowledges the sanctity of independence as celebrated by Jack Kerouac? Now, Our Divided Political Heart grew out of my love for the American story and its tensions. There's a kind of paradox in the book because the first sentence refers to widespread worries about American decline, but the book is very distinctly an anti-declinist book. It's a hopeful book about our future because it argues that the classic American balance between individualism and community, and also between the government and the market and the private and the public, has helped us get out of scrapes many times before and can do so again. I never tire of quoting Winston Churchill, who offered my very favorite take on us. Americans can always be counted on to do the right thing, he said, after they have first exhausted all of the other possibilities. It takes us time, but we get there. The fact that we talk so much about decline is actually a sign of what a high opinion we actually have of our country. We always think we're somewhere from which we can decline. And it's also the case that out of fears of decline have come some extraordinary politicians and some extraordinary political campaigns. FDR, most notably, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. The feelings of decline usually start in specific crises over foreign policy or economics, or, as was the case at the end of the Bush administration, both. But these concerns quickly morph into a sense that we are in a spiritual crisis. We start asking ourselves the core question, who are we? We debate our history and history's lessons and disagree about what they are. Barack Obama's election was very much rooted in the sense that he was a person to solve that spiritual crisis. His campaign seemed geared to it. Those posters carrying the single word hope with his picture, or remember the slogan, change, we can believe it. I have always thought that the word believe was at least as important in that slogan as the word change. It is no wonder, hope and believe, it is no wonder that the 2008 Obama campaign so often felt like a religious crusade. And it's no accident that the Tea Party also responded to this sense of spiritual crisis by reaching back to the founders and to our Constitution. And in my book is in some ways inspired by the Tea Party. I thank them for their interest in our history, even as it is very critical of their view of who we are and their take on the American story. The Tea Party was right to go back to the origins of our country, and those of us who are progressive need to join the argument with them. We progressives, I think, have been too willing to leave the argument about American history to the right. We have been too reluctant to embrace the American story, which I believe is a progressive story. Our conservative friends should not be the only people who carry around copies of the Constitutions in their pockets. Do we have to leave quoting the Federalist to them? Why do we leave the Declaration to them? The most forward-looking politicians and moral spokespeople in our history did not do that. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech drew its inspiration from the promises of American history, and in particular from the promises of the Declaration of Independence. The entire first part of the speech is a reflection on American history. Dr. King, for those of you who've listened to that speech as often as I have, you'll remember this, that he spoke of that promissory note given to African Americans that had come back stamped unpaid insufficient funds. It was a very powerful way for him to make his case for equal justice. Abraham Lincoln's most important political speech before he was president was at Cooper Union in New York City, where he insisted that the founders of our nation ultimately foresaw, as he did, the extinction of slavery in the United States. Lincoln did months of historical research to give the speech that the historian Harold Holzer thinks made him president. What do I mean by our divided political heart? The core argument of my book is that from the beginning, Americans have been torn by a deep, but I believe healthy tension between our love of individualism and our affection for community. Too often, and especially in recent years, we have told our story almost entirely on the individualistic side. We have emphasized individual liberty to the exclusion of our dedication to community. We have not focused enough on how the liberty we do prize depends upon our willingness to come to the defense of each other's liberty, how liberty depends on strong communities, energetic government, and a concern for the common good. Consider the very first word of the Constitution of the United States. The word is not I, the word is we. In the preamble of the Constitution of the United States, the preamble reads, we, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare. Yes, welfare is in the first paragraph of the Constitution of the United States. And secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution. The Declaration of Independence is a perfect reflection of the balance between the individual and the community. It begins by describing those unalienable rights with which we are all familiar to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But in the last paragraph of the Declaration, the founders pledge their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. They understood that they could not accomplish their task alone. They knew that they could not protect individual liberty unless they acted together. Because of this book and because of the Tea Party, I actually went back and reread the Declaration July 4th. And many of you remember that wonderful list of abuses and usurpations that Jefferson mainly and his co-authors listed, all the reasons why we were breaking away from Britain and the king. It is worth noting that taxes did not come up until the 17th item on their list. And their objection was not to taxes as such. They were upset at the British Crown for imposing taxes on us without our consent. They were concerned about consent, popular rule, not taxes. The very first item on their list condemned the king because he, quotes, refused his assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. Note that the signers wanted to pass laws, not repeal them, and they began speaking of the public good, not just of individuals. The second grievance was like the first, accusing the king of having forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance. Again, our forebears wanted to enact laws. They were not anti-government zealots. The Declaration doesn't even get to anything that looks like big government oppression. And for those who are anti-big government activists today, I urge them at least to do as well as the Declaration of Independence did. I'll just read this to you because I like it. He's talking about the king. They are talking about the king. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out our substance. Their substance. That's a whole lot better than you'll get in some of those 30-second ads financed by the Koch brothers this fall. We've had a parallel argument related to government in our history. I have a lot of fun in this book going back through the legacies of Hamilton and Clay and Abraham Lincoln and also to our populist and progressive traditions. I have said this to him that David Brooks, whom I argue with on the radio a lot, I told David that one of the true joys, and I mean this, of writing this book is I understand now why David is utterly crosswise to current American politics, because he is the last living, surviving American Whig. His politics are almost, and I mean that as a kind of compliment, his politics are very much out of Henry Clay. And I was describing to someone how both of us like the Whigs. And this person suggested that we could organize the most boring event in American history. We could call it Wigstock. I don't think we're going to do that. If you want to argue that the federal government played little role in the development of our country, you have to read Hamilton, Clay, Lincoln, and many others out of our story. Consider this. Think about this question. When was the first federal health care program passed? And the answer to the question is in 1798, when the Congress of the United States passed the Federal Marine Hospital System, and John Adams, President John Adams, signed it. Apparently, either the seamen had really powerful lobby, or we were worried about diseases they were bringing home. But we had socialized medicine for seamen in 1798. There were hospitals all over the country, and I can find no record in our history of mass demonstrations against Adams care. And if you believe that the Constitution is absolutely clear and can be read only one way, then you have to deal with the fact that within 3 years of the enactment of the federal Constitution, Alexander Hamilton and James Madison, two of its leading interpreters and authors, were at each other's throats over whether the idea, Hamilton's idea, to establish a Bank of the United States was constitutional or not. I'm not sure how you can have a clear sense of originalism when the two original guys were arguing over what the document said. My chapter on the Constitution is called One Nation Conceived in Argument. And I couldn't resist quoting my friend, the legal scholar Garrett Epps, who said that Justice Scalia and other originalists root their jurisprudence in this idea, quotes, "I knew the founders. The founders were friends of mine. I know how they think." The Constitution, as we all know from school, was created out of a series of compromises. It defends competing values, competing goods, as former Justice David Souter has said. We do ourselves a great disservice, I think, to see the founders as unique or sainted and to believe they received the Constitution as tablets handed down from heaven. They were gifted men, and we have every reason to be grateful to them for the document they wrote. But they were also adventurous, embarking on a radical experiment for their time, rooted in the idea that a people could govern themselves. Many people didn't think this radical idea could work. To think of the Constitution as a set of shackles designed to keep our country in exactly the same condition it was in 1787 and to prevent us from addressing new problems in new ways does a disservice to the bold and adventurous nature of our founders. Now, thank you. Now, Hamilton and Clay, for their part, were visionaries. They admired what might be seen as national planning. Henry Clay called his program the American system. And what's intriguing about this is that he called it the American system to distinguish it from the British system, which was rooted in laissez-faire. That is to say, the American system wasn't laissez-faire. The American system saw how government could contribute to the growth of our country. He proposed substantial federal help for internal improvements, those bridges and roads and canals that bound the nation together. And if my book achieves nothing else, I hope we replace that ugly word, infrastructure, with internal improvements. We might actually get somewhere on funding them. Clay foresaw, as Hamilton did, an important role for the federal government in building us into a manufacturing nation. He was more than a century ahead of Nixon in proposing what we came to call federal revenue sharing for the states. In frustration when his opponents were saying his program was unconstitutional, he said, and in particular his efforts to help American manufacturing against other nations manufacturing, he said, "Do we live in the only country in the world with a constitution that is written for other countries but not for ourselves?" And so, like many progressives, including FDR much later, Clay expressed his frustration with those who refused to see the Constitution as a liberating document. I argue that our friends in the Tea Party are looking back, in fact, to an exceptional period in our history as typical. There is one period in our history when the kind of radical individualism that I see them espousing, a radical individualism as against the tempered American individualism, that's the period of the Gilded Age in the 35 years after the end of the Civil War. And it was in this period that the Supreme Court issued decisions that some of which we are still living with. It was in this period, for example, where corporations were declared people, which the Supreme Court has taken to a remarkable and, I believe, very destructive place in its Citizens United decision. And I believe the best statement in opposition to this idea came from Stephen Colbert. And Stephen Colbert said that when he heard this, he wanted his daughter to grow up and marry a really nice corporation. It's also toward the end of this period that the famous Lochner decision was made. That was which said that the government couldn't regulate the hours of, in that case, bakery workers. And it took the populists and progressives, who are seen as big government interlopers, to actually restore that longer American tradition of balance represented in the early republic. They believed that government had a role to play. Herbert Croly, the great progressive thinker who influenced Teddy Roosevelt, argued that progressives sought to use Hamiltonian means to serve Jeffersonian ends. They wanted an active federal government to ensure greater equality of opportunity and an economy that would not be dominated by trusts or by a very small number of people. Those who are looking for encouragement in our debates now can go back to some of the things that Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson said, notably in their 1912 campaign. They sound like people who had been hanging around Occupy Wall Street encampments. Here's what Woodrow Wilson said. He said, "The country was nearing a time when the power of high finance would be greater than the power of government." Sounds kind of relevant to me. In my telling, the populists and progressives who rebelled against the Gilded Age did not suddenly foist big government on the nation. They restored the American tradition of balance. Teddy Roosevelt and Wilson, and their flag was picked up later by FDR, inaugurated what I call the long consensus. It was the long consensus that created what we came to call the American century. It fostered a period of extraordinary economic growth and innovation, but it was also a time of shared growth. In the 100 years since Teddy Roosevelt assumed the presidency, government did grow, but so did individual liberty. The state assumed new roles, but individual opportunities expanded. New regulations protected the air and the water, the integrity of our food and drugs, the safety of our workplaces and consumer products, and American capitalism flourished. Workers organized into unions that advanced the interests of those who depended on their labor, not capital, for their livelihoods. In so doing, labor organizations strengthened a more social form of capitalism based on widespread property ownership and upward mobility. Previously excluded groups were steadily brought in to the larger American community to share in the economy's bounty and in the responsibilities of self-government. We continued to welcome newcomers and created the most diverse democracy on earth. I believe this long consensus is now under attack as it has never been under attack before. What needs to be recognized is how far republicanism and conservatism have strayed from their own history and their own past commitments. They have chosen, on principle, it should be said, to make middle ground in politics impossible. They have done so by jettisoning their communitarian commitments, by adopting a highly restrictive view of the federal government's role, by advancing in the Supreme Court, no less than on the campaign trail, a view of the Constitution that would prohibit or restrict activities that the federal government has undertaken for a century or more. And when two sides do not operate within the same framework, identify the same problems, or even share a common understanding of our history, the difficulty of finding accord cannot be ascribed simply to pettiness or selfishness. It reflects the fact that the country has reached a time of choosing, which is the title of Ronald Reagan's memorable 1964 speech on behalf of Barry Goldwater. Now, I write it with great respect in my book for the conservative tradition. But conservatives, I hope temporarily, have for now abandoned their communitarian sympathies for a defense of radical individualism quite distinct, as I said, from American individualism. One of William F. Buckley Jr., that great American conservative, one of William F. Buckley Jr.'s last books was called Gratitude, in which he strenuously argued that those who had enjoyed the protections and the bounties of this country owed something back to the country. I dare say that he might lose a primary if he offered that view today. Conservatives have constricted their programmatic imagination to cuts in taxes, regulation, and government. Now, I do believe that every society needs a constructive form of conservatism. We don't like it, we progressives, but it's right that they should subject our grand plans, when we put them forward, to merciless interrogation. And I'm talking about serious interrogation, not death panels. We need them to remind us that not all of the old ways are bad ways just because they are old. I would like to see a time when conservatives and progressives can reason together again. And I hope that pointing to both sides of our political heart, conservatives and progressives might recognize a bit of ourselves in the other. Conservatives politically may have abandoned the idea of community, but we know how many of them coach sports teams or are active in PTAs and Rotary clubs and churches and a slew of other activities reaching out to others. Liberals have always cared vitally about liberty. Where do civil libertarians come from, after all? Perhaps after this election, we can try to sit down and talk again. In the meantime, we have to settle our argument. Now, I want to close in three ways. I want to close, as I said at the beginning, by linking FDR, John Winthrop, and Bruce Springsteen. And those of you who suspect that a humble book writer is trying to link himself to Springsteen in order to get a small percentage of his fans, though you suspicious people would be entirely right, I am. But I actually do think that what he is singing now is vitally connected to our tradition. First, John Winthrop. You all remember that Ronald Reagan loved to talk about us as a shining city on a hill. That actually goes all the way back to John Winthrop's 1630 sermon, in which he called a model of Christian charity, in which he referred to us as a city set upon a hill. Here's what one of the things Winthrop said. He said, "We must delight in each other, make others' conditions our own, rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together, always having before our eyes our community as members of the same body." Does anyone doubt that Rush Limbaugh would call this great Puritan a socialist? Then it was here at the Commonwealth Club where FDR gave probably the clearest speech he gave about what was going to happen in the New Deal. A lot of 1932 campaign was actually Roosevelt talked about how we had not balanced the budget. It was all kinds of stuff that really ended up having very little to do with what he did in office. But the Commonwealth Club speech told you where he was going. And I don't think anybody understood the American balance better than FDR. Every man has a right to his own property, which means a right to be assured to the fullest extent attainable in the safety of his savings. But by no other means can men carry the burdens of those parts of life which, in the nature of things, afford no chance of labor, childhood, sickness, old age. In all thought of property, this right is paramount. All other property rights must yield to it. If, in accord with this principle, we must restrict the operations of the speculator, the manipulator, even the financier, I believe we must accept the restriction as needful, not to hamper individualism, but to protect it. Long before the Great Recession, when financial institutions received government bailouts to ensure their survival and then complained about government interference in the face of reforms aimed at preventing a repeat of the abuses, Roosevelt was very aware of this inconsistency, one could say hypocrisy, but he made his case very gently. Here's what he said. "The same man who tells you that he does not want to see the government interfere in business, and he means it, and he has plenty of good reasons for saying so, is the first to go to Washington and ask the government for a prohibitory tariff on his product. When things get just bad enough, as they did 2 years ago, he will go with equal speed to the United States government and ask for a loan. And the Reconstruction Finance Corporation is the outcome of it. Each group has sought protection from government for its own special interest without realizing that the function of government must be to favor no small group at the expense of its duty to protect the rights of personal freedom and private property of all its citizens." And lastly, Roosevelt on balance. We know that individual liberty and individual happiness mean nothing unless both are ordered in the sense that one man's meat is not another man's poison. We know the old rights of personal competency, the right to read, to think, to speak, to choose, and live a mode of life must be respected at all hazards. We know that liberty to do anything which deprives others of these elemental rights is outside the protection of any compact, and that government in this regard is the maintenance of a balance within which every individual has a place if he will take it, in which every individual may find safety if he wishes it, in which every individual may attain such power as his ability permits, consistent with his assuming the accompanying responsibility. So we have John Winthrop talking about sharing with each other. We have Franklin Roosevelt talking powerfully about community. And finally, we've got the boss. I don't know how many of you have heard the new Springsteen album, but the first song in it is a wonderful song. And the refrain of that song is, wherever this flag is flown, we take care of our own. So from John Winthrop, who said we must mourn together and labor and suffer together and keep an eye on each other, all the way to Bruce Springsteen from 1630 to 2012, we have had this idea of the common good. This is a part of America, being American, that has made us a great people. It is a part of us we should not forget. It's a part of us that we should never be afraid to celebrate. Thank you all very, very much. Thank you.
Thank you. And our thanks to E.J. Dionne, Washington Post columnist, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and author of the new book, Our Divided Political Heart. Now we have some time for audience questions, and we have quite a few of them, many of them quite topical, some relating to the book, but others on the political topics of the day. So let's just get right to them. You know, we always see politicians run for office and talk about how they're going to overcome the divide. They're the one, I'm a uniter, not a divider. We heard that from George W. Bush. Barack Obama talked about it. Jerry Brown, when he was running for governor this time, talked about bringing everyone together. And then when they get in there, they find out how difficult it is, and they express surprise and frustration. Is that hubris? Is it naivete? Why is it that everyone runs on that same platform and then is unable to overcome that divide?
Well, I don't think it's always been true that they couldn't overcome that divide. I mean, I think that we've gone through phases. I mean, the one period where we might have been even more divided than we are now is in the 1850s, right before the Civil War. Maybe that's when we met in the New York Times newsroom.
I remember
And obviously we saw what happened. I mean, again, there were fundamental differences about the definition of what the Union meant, about what the country was about what slavery meant. You really had one part of the country arguing that slavery was a form of liberty, that is to say, their liberty to ownership and not to have contracts interfered with. So we've been there before, but I think that there was a much more consensual period once we settled the fight over the Gilded Age. And there was some contention, there was some rollback in the 20s, but by and large, even George W. Bush and Ronald Reagan largely lived within the long consensus. I mean, Reagan did cut back a lot of things, and I think he began certain tendencies that have been aggravated, that have hurt our economy, that have sort of contributed to inequality. But when it came time to, he had given a lot of speeches about the repeal of Social Security, but when the crisis came, he actually raised taxes to save Social Security. He didn't try to repeal Medicare. He raised taxes 11 times. When you look at George W. Bush, there are three major domestic achievements. One were those very unfortunate, in my view, tax cuts. But the other two were very much in the long consensus. The additional benefit, the prescription drug benefit, adding to Medicare, a program created by LBJ, and his No Child Left Behind Act, which used federal power through federal aid, established first by FDR and then really under Lyndon Johnson, in order to reform the schools. So I think that we have had that long consensus has come apart, and you've got, you know, in a sense, one side still believing in that consensus and the other side not. And I know you had my friends Tom Mann and Orm Ornstein here a few weeks back. And I do not think it's a partisan or ideological statement to say that the right has moved farther right than the left has moved left. I mean, there's evidence, particularly on economic issues and issues related to government. There was a recent survey by the Pew Research Center that really demonstrated that quite clearly. And so I think we, in some ways, we've had a problem ever since George H.W. Bush signed that tax increase in the 90s, which helped cost him the election and which kind of pushed the Republicans to a point where they would never, ever again, vote for a tax increase. And that's sort of part of where they are now. And I also think we can probably talk about this. Political money has kind of encouraged, accelerated this move to the right. I also think the business community, significant parts of the business community, which used to be, and parts of it still are, quite moderate and practical, significant parts of the business community moved to the right in that period. I think all of that's aggravated the difficulty. Even in times of great prosperity, Bill Clinton got impeached. I mean, this is a very, been a very odd moment.
Let's talk about Citizens United. You brought up political money. Citizens United, campaign donations, the super PACs that we're seeing the rise of this year, and all the what will end up being hundreds of millions of dollars spent. How is that pulling the conservatives to the right, and what effect is it having on the Democrats, and what do you think will be the net effect this year, at least in the short term, of all this new money pouring into the system?
Well, I think when you look at the rise of the Tea Party, I think some of it came in reaction to Obama. Some of it came in reaction to President Bush's failures. But the Tea Party took off in part because they had, first of all, a television network of their own. They had a whole troop of talk show hosts all over the country. They had a media obsessed for about 2 years with Sarah Palin, where the surest way to get page views on a website was to use the word Sarah Palin, because people who hated her came to it, the people who loved her came to it. But lastly, there was the money that poured in to support their politics. So, and it wasn't just the brothers Koch, who had long supported libertarian causes before that, but it was a lot of others whom I think sort of pushed a very particular right-wing or conservative agenda. I also think that what's aggravated it is the departure of moderates from the Republican Party. I joke sometimes that if you don't like this, you can blame it on Bill Clinton. And I say that not because Clinton is at fault for this, but because in the 90s, he attracted a lot of those moderate Republicans into the Democratic Party. And you saw real changes in, some of those suburban counties like the collar around Philadelphia. Those have been a base for moderate Republicanism, people like John Hines. Now they are swing counties. They vote for Democrats often, and they don't vote in Republican primaries anymore. So I think that has also had the effect of creating a quite different Republican Party than the one we used to have.
We've seen the impact already of the Tea Party and the Occupy Wall Street movement in the presidential primary season. Which of those movements do you expect to have the greater impact in November?
Some of it depends on how the election turns out. I think that the Tea Party had a very significant influence on the primaries by pushing Mitt Romney steadily to the right, by giving significant success, the Tea Party, along with the religious conservative movement, to Rick Santorum and occasionally to Newt Gingrich. They were also having quite a bit of effect in Republican organizing conventions for Ron Paul. They're clearly very committed to voting, and they are an older group of Americans. I think in many ways they're just the traditional right end or right and far right of the electorate. And we will always have 20% of us will be kind of, at least 20% of us will be on that end of the political spectrum. But I think Occupy, I doubt they will have anything like the same electoral effect, but I do think they have already had a major effect in changing the conversation. Because we were not talking as much as we are now or as much as we should about economic inequality in the country. The whole idea of the top 1% is now routinely in the conversation. That's a huge victory. Newspapers are now writing features about what it takes to be in the top 1% in our area. Now, once you get into feature stories, you really change the conversation. And so I think if Occupy does nothing else, it's already had a very important effect. So electoral on-the-ground troops, probably the Tea Party, but in terms of long-term effect on our debate, I still think it's quite possible that Occupy's effect will be important over the longer term.
Okay, here's a question from the audience. How influential has the rise of Christian fundamentalism been in encouraging polarization in the United States?
Well, I see that as part of an earlier story. Certainly there is some polarization around issues like gay rights, around abortion. Although what's really striking is I think the cause of gay rights and people in San Francisco probably know this better than anyone because you're at the forefront of it. The change in the country on attitudes toward gays and lesbians is stunning in how fast it has happened. The Stonewall Revolt happened in 69, but really in about 20 years, the country has changed its mind in fundamental ways in its attitude on these questions. So while people might talk about, well, are we moving right in some ways, in this respect, on gay rights, certainly, the movement is all the other way. And it's even affecting younger evangelical Christians. It is such a totally age-related age-related attitude. Many younger evangelicals are still pro-life or anti-abortion, and they are not unlike their parents. But on gay issues, they're very different from their parents. So that I think right now the polarization, although you see it around social issues, is really much more around these economic issues and issues related to government. I think you have a new form of polarization created since the rise, before the rise of the Tea Party, but reaching a kind of critical mass with the Tea Party.
Well, clearly President Obama has been pulled by the chains socially on gay marriage, and now since he has come out in favor of it, black voters have started switching in polls and supporting it more than they did before. What impact do you think his decision to endorse same-sex marriage might have in November?
I'm not sure it'll have an enormous impact because, on the one hand, there may be some voters he might have had a shot at, more socially conservative voters who aren't necessarily wild about Mitt Romney's economics. Perhaps if some of them will be pushed away. But I think he's picking up. He really needed more energy among younger voters than he had. And I think there will be some pickup in that sphere. I think, obviously, it's also helped his fundraising significantly, not only among gays, but among social liberals in general. So I'm not sure it could have put, if he loses North Carolina, some people will ascribe it to this, and perhaps that'll be reasonable. But I think it may turn out to be a wash. It's striking that Republicans have not jumped on this the way President Bush jumped on gay marriage in 2004. I think that shows you how quickly things have changed on this question.
What role is technology playing in making America more divided or more united? And, on the one hand, you would say social media is a unifying community. On the other hand, it tends to be rather narcissistic and self-centered, which is more towards individualism, which reminds me, you can follow me on Twitter if you want. It's Sovereign Nation.
Yes.
But do you think it is, in its end result, more towards the community side or the individualism side, and is it having an impact?
I just started tweeting with this book. I decided I needed to join social media. My wife and I had gone to see Death of a Salesman in New York, this great new production, and we took the train home and got home really late. The train was late. And I slept till 11 o'clock for the first time in about 15 years or 20 years, and I came down, looked at my family, and I said, well, I'm tweeting, I'm on Facebook, and I'm getting up at 11 o'clock. I'm a teenager. If only my joints felt that way. I think social media, it's interesting. Think of the term social media, that these are deeply sort of individualistic at their heart. And yet, when people come to it, particularly younger Americans, they quickly form social networks. They can bring people together. People have used them as used the social media as organizing tools, not only in political campaigns, but in their neighborhoods. I think the new technologies are more efficient in many ways. So they make the dissemination of truth easier. They also make the dissemination of lies easier. They make it possible to reach out to points of view not only that you didn't agree with but never even imagined existed, but they also allow you to cocoon yourself inside your own world and hear nothing but ideas that reinforce what you already believe. And so I'm not sure that we kind of hang the whole thing on social media. I think there are some respects in which they may have made cocooning a little more likely. But I think I point more to these political factors than to technological factors as to our division. One thing that is true, really interesting book by a guy called Bill Bishop called The Big Sort that some of you may be familiar with. We're tending to live more and more with people who think like we do. And we don't set out to do that, but we end up picking neighborhoods and places where people agree with us. I always like to joke, I live in an extremely open-minded precinct in Bethesda, Maryland, and our open-minded people voted 80% for Barack Obama. I actually respect people who have Republican signs in our neighborhood because it takes real courage. There are other neighborhoods across the river in Virginia where exactly the opposite is the case. So I think that kind of sort of social cocooning is maybe farther, you know, there's always been a lot of that in our society. I think it may be a little farther along than it used to be. We're even picking houses of worship depending on our politics in a way I don't think we used to. And that kind of troubles me because you'd like to think that's one place where you might come together with people you disagree with and both pray for redemption together.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest is Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne. We're discussing the challenged political climate in America. I'm Doug Sovereign, and I would say probably most of the people here have sorted themselves into agreeing with you and coming from the same part of the spectrum, but not everyone. Here's a question from the audience. Individuals from another political philosophy might suggest that you're trying to impose your morals on society. What is your response? Perhaps morals isn't the right word there, but...
No, well, it's an interesting question, actually, whoever asked it. It's a fair question. I think all law is at some level based on some version of morality. If we're going to take our laws on theft and murder come out of some morality. And that we do argue about which, where should we use law to impose our morality and where should we not use law. I say in the book that, you know, I have a lot of communitarian sympathies, but prohibition is the single worst failed communitarian experiment in our history. And it's actually worth remembering that prohibition wasn't just a right-wing idea. There were a lot of progressives who were in favor of prohibition because they were worried about the condition of the poor, the effect of drink on poor families. And the question is, I guess, from if the person is coming sort of from the right side of things, you know, am I imposing my morality by suggesting that government has some role to play in writing inequalities or redistributing income? I would be prepared to say that I am for that in part on moral grounds. And we could argue about it. I always think of the welfare state as our bad conscience because we know we never give enough out of our own pockets to the poor. We especially don't give to the poor we don't know. The people on the other side of town, the people who don't look like us, the people we don't run into all the time. And that's one of the reasons we use government to do it. But I would also argue, but it would take longer than we would not want to take that up tonight, that and I think it's important that progressives make this case, that our economy works better when we do not have radical inequalities. We will always have substantial inequalities. But the last time inequality hit this level was in the 1928-29 period, and we saw what happened then. I think we are all better off if we have a reasonable distribution of income where the bottom isn't quite so far away from the top as it is today. And again, you'll have wealth. You want it. I have nothing against people succeeding, but I think the gap is way too big and that it's very bad for us as a society, and I think it's bad for us as an economy.
How would you compare our balance or lack thereof between self and community to Europe's, where at the moment there is a bit of a backlash against what may turn out to have been too much economic community?
Well, I'm not sure. You know, it's funny. The welfare state in Germany takes a larger share of its, some of you may have read Paul Krugman this morning who made this point. The welfare state in Germany takes a larger share of their GDP than the Greek welfare state. So is it really the welfare state that's the problem in Europe? The German economy is exceedingly successful. So is the Swedish economy. So is the Norwegian economy. So is the Danish economy. There are a lot of social democratic economies. You know, so is the Australian economy, which is sort of somewhere between Europe and us. So I just don't agree with that particular analysis of Europe. The advantage, you know, what we have historically that the Europeans don't, and this is kind of a conservative point I'm making, is that the Europeans have relied more on the state for all kinds of forms of social provision. Now, in some cases, I think they're right about that. You're not going to do there are certain forms of basic income support and health care you've got to do through the state. But we have had, and now Europeans are kind of looking to us to see what they can learn from us, or they were before the whole world went kablooey, how we organize all those sort of community efforts that Tocqueville wrote about. And that I am, you know, an area where I've done work over the years with conservatives is on the third sector, including but not limited to the faith-based sector. And, you know, I like the American mix of a, you know, I like a more generous generous public provision by the state, but I also like the existence of a large charitable and community-building independent sector, and you need them to work together effectively.
Here's some nuts and bolts questions. Who do you think Mitt Romney will choose as his running mate if he had to pick someone today?
Well, I can assure you he won't ask me I mean, for advice. I mean, he's not going to pick me, but for advice.
Sarah Palin off the list.
Sarah Palin is not going to do it this time. Conventional wisdom is he's going to go for somebody really safe like Rob Portman, mm-hmm. Who is a smart guy. He did serve in the Bush administration, which will strengthen the Obama argument that you're going back to Bush. I'll just do two somewhat slightly dark horses that I think have more of a shot than they're given credit for now. One is Tim Pawlenty, whom Romney seems to like quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And the other is Bobby Jindal, whom I think still is in the mix. So those are my two. If either happens, you can give me credit for being a great pundit. And if neither happens, I hope you forget entirely what I said
despite
the tape, you know.
Neither one of them has exactly thrilled audiences when given the chance.
Right, but there's a limited. I think he is going to go safer rather than thrill-seeking, mm-hmm. And that's because of Sarah Palin. You know, and if he watched the movie Game Change, that only
right.
reinforced this view.
Or read the book. Does that mitigate against Marco Rubio?
I don't think Rubio is going to be on the ticket, is just my feeling. And I think after the difficulties Romney has had over Obama's kind of Dream Act this mm-hmm. week, which resembled the Rubio Dream Act, it makes it complicated. You know, he is young, he's interesting, Florida is hugely important. Romney needs more Latino support than he's getting now. I just have a feeling it's not going to be Rubio. But again,
is that another as we see Obama making moves to activate his base, the Dream Act? He's going for Latinos, for younger voters, trying to energize and excite the younger voters again. When does he make the play more for the independents, or did we see that last week with the speech in Ohio?
Well, first of all, there are many different kinds of independents. There are a lot of independents lean Republican and aren't real independents. A lot of independents lean Democratic and aren't real independents. And I think that the broad argument over what Republican budgets would look like, the kind of, you know, trying to tie Romney to the Ryan budget, I think that is simultaneously an effort to shore up his base or energize his base and win over the independents. And, you know, he said in the speech in Cleveland last week that he would love to work with Republicans or who are prepared to work with him. He's just under no illusions that describes most actually existing Republicans at the moment. And so I think you're seeing a little bit of both. I think his, you know, one of his most important tasks is to re-energize young people. You know, who've really been hammered in this economy, and you can't run as a kind of savior twice, you know, especially with the unemployment rate being where it is, and you can't create the kind of excitement that existed in 2008 in the same way again. I think he's got a lot of work to do, because I don't think it's that young people will vote overwhelmingly for Romney. I think the question is, or even that, you know, the young people who vote, I think, will vote substantially for Obama. The question is by how much and how many of them will actually vote.
Now, in California, we've gone to the top two open primary, which some of the East Coast pundits like yourself call the jungle primary.
I haven't used the term yet, but I do like the term.
It is pretty good. We're in the wild jungle out here in California.
I've heard Californians describe it that way. But particularly people who lost in the jungle.
Exactly. So now, in some cases, in November, we've got Democrat against Democrat, Republican against Republican. We have no party preference. Do you think this is promising or chaotic, and should other states emulate California?
No. I don't like this. I don't like a system that produces a November election with two Republicans or two Democrats on the ballot. I don't think that makes sense. I think you could have an open primary if you wanted one without having the result be that there, you know, in districts where, you know, Democrats really want to elect a Democratic congressperson or Republicans really want to elect a Republican, they don't have that option on the ballot. I think that's a mistake in this jungle primary.
This is a question you address in great detail in your book, but someone maybe who hasn't read it yet and should go buy a copy after we're done.
Yeah, I refuse to answer. You just got to go buy the book to get the answer.
Is America in decline?
I don't think so. I mean, first of all, a funny story. A visiting minister from another country, a high official of another country, was visiting us, and it was a dinner for him, and it was a bipartisan group of people around the table. And he said, if you want to just get a comprehensive budget deal for the next 10 years, and that will kill all the talk of American decline all over the world, particularly in Asia, where he was talking about. And then the people at the party, Republicans and Democrats, immediately took to fighting each other over the problems with creating it. And this foreign friend of the United States said, all right, you don't want my help? Go into decline if you want to. But I don't think that we are facing decline. I mean, first of all, it's a myth that we ever utterly dominated the world, that the world always did what we said. Remember the name Charles de Gaulle? Remember a lot of people in the world who just, you know, we didn't dictate to the world. I don't think we should want to dictate to the world. Secondly, I never liked the term sole remaining superpower. Yes, after the Soviet Union fell, there was a moment when we seemed far more dominant than anyone else, but that was never going to last. It was not a natural state of things. And I think the United States can have an enormous influence in the world over a very long period of time as other nations rise. I don't believe that wealthy Americans lost influence when we created a much bigger middle class, when more Americans shared wealth and power. I still think we are going to be, if we don't wreck it at home, if we don't make ourselves ungovernable, I think we're going to be a very powerful country in the world for a very long time if we want to be. But we have to solve, we have to learn to govern ourselves again. We have to have political arguments that are designed to get to a conclusion and solve some problems. Arthur Schlesinger said democratic politics should be about remedy. And I always think we should keep that in the back of our minds. When we're not engaged in searching for remedies, something is wrong with the way we're doing politics.
Now, you're not the first to write this sort of book. In fact, you've written somewhat similar books before. Do the voters, do the politicians heed any of what's in these books, or is it just the media, the chattering classes, the people who come hear you speak and nod their heads? What impact do books like this actually have practically when it's all said and done?
It varies a lot from book to book, and it depends on the time. I mean, Why Americans Hate Politics had a lot of influence on politicians. I mean, I've been told I even had a friend who said, you cost me $50,000 because I read your book, I thought I could win, and I got clobbered. Bill Clinton quoted the book a lot in 1992, and other people have. So sometimes you're lucky in that way, and, you know, it depends on circumstance. I would argue that this book is, in the same spirit as Why Americans Hate Politics, it's a different kind of book, because that book was largely about sort of what the problems with ideological politics in the 30 years from 1960 to 1990. This is much more about a longer take on American history and a country far more polarized than when I wrote Why Americans Hate Politics. Somebody once told me that Why Americans Hate Politics turned them into a conservative. And that, you know, that was obviously not the purpose of a writer like me. But he said my treatment of conservatives was sympathetic, and I made them look attractive, and he wanted to look into it more, and he's become a fairly prominent conservative. This book is more critical of conservatism, even though I have the same spirit toward them that I had in Why Americans Hate Politics, because I think the conservatism we see today is not the same as a conservatism which I still opposed then, but was attracted to in certain ways and found, you know, I thought there are humane forms of conservatism, and I still wish we could have them again.
I think we're just about out of time, but I really wanted to ask this one last question from the audience just to catch all. Maybe you can answer briefly. What do we do now?
Don't mourn, organize. I mean, we're going to have to settle this argument in this election. I believe that the American tradition of balance is the way we need to go. I think that progressives need to be far less afraid to say we really do believe that government contributes a great deal to justice and growth in our nation. And we are often so reluctant just to say that, you know, mumble, 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 yeah, government's okay, but boy, am I really for the private sector. I mean, there is a kind of reluctance to say this. Attached to that should also be a commitment to reforming government. I think government reform is much more important to progressives than it is to conservatives, because we rely on government to do some good and important things for society. And when government fails, when voters lose faith in government's capacity to fix things and promote justice, in the long run, progressives lose. So I think defending government on the one hand and reforming it on the other is what we need to do.
Our thanks to E.J. Dionne, Washington Post columnist.
Thank you.
His book is Our Divided Political Heart. And we also thank our audience here and on the radio, television, and the internet. We want to remind everyone that copies of Mr. Dionne's book, Our Divided Political Heart, are on sale in the lobby. He will be pleased to sign them for you right outside this room. I'm Doug Sovereign of KCBS Radio in San Francisco, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.